Hello, and welcome to our first edition of the Thursday Gardening Program. I'm Brian Earle, your host, and with me today in studio is Diane Alston, USU's Extension Entomologist, and we hope that you'll make 10 o'clock on Thursdays a regular time for you to tune in to Utah Public Radio and also to call with your questions or comments. A lot to talk about right now. Gardening is really getting underway, even though there's still a little over a foot of snow in my front yard. Things to do inside and things to be aware of to prepare for the coming year. So one thing I wanted to mention first before I forget is there is an Urban and Small Farms Conference. It's February 26th through 27th, so that's next week. And it's at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. They have a pre-conference entitled the Organic Fruit and Vegetable Workshop. That's on Tuesday the 26th. And then the main conference is on Wednesday, February 27th. So they'll have season extension techniques. The Utah berry growers are involved. Urban farming topics. Local food production. Registration is $30 per day. And for information, go to diverseag.org/SLC, stands for Salt Lake City. So again, diverseag.org/SLC. And they have different tracks. There's the berry vegetable track. There's a production track. There's direct marketing and management. Everything from cottage food and incubator kitchens to bees and pesticides, irrigation of small plots. So Diane, would you say that this is geared for an individual or more someone who wants to do maybe a little more commercial production?
It really is geared towards the small commercial producers. So those that are perhaps marketing to gardeners or farmers market customers, those are maybe running community supported agriculture gardens, you know, that kind of thing. But certainly it's, greenhouse producers, field producers, it doesn't matter. It's very diverse. We had a conference, the Diversified Agriculture has been around as a conference for about 10 years, and it moves around in different locations of the state. But last year, for the first time, they held it in a more urban location. It was in Kaysville. And the attendance was just phenomenal, and the amount of interest in people that are growing, perhaps their hobby farm, sometimes their full-time jobs. It was very variable, but people were just very interested in sharing information and knowledge and learning about small farm production. And so we're having a repeat performance this year held in Salt Lake City. And as you read off, there's just a real wide variety of topics.
Well, even the pre-conference on Tuesday, long-term effects of four ground cover management systems in an apple orchard, a year in the life of an organic peach, principles of sustainable weed management. I mean, a lot of very interesting topics.
Very interesting. We have some outside speakers, especially for that organic session, as well as on the 27th as well. So again, it's geared towards all kinds of small farm producers, even backyard producers, I'm sure could learn a lot of neat things.
So diverseag.org/SLC. Well, let's dive into our topics for the day. You're an entomologist, so that means insects.
Of course.
And so what do you have to discuss in the middle of February?
Well, I thought a very timely topic might be just talking about ways that insects can survive the winter. We get a common question. In fact, you've asked me many times on this show. So we've had a mild winter or we've had a severe winter. So what does that mean in terms of how insects are going to, how many there will be this year, how much of a problem they might be in the garden?
Last year was somewhat mild.
And now this year we've had, a lot of cold temperatures. We've had quite a bit of snowfall. And so how might those differences affect? And they certainly do, but overall I'll have to say that insects have evolved to be able to tolerate, variability. Because you can imagine, one warm winter, if it decimated the insect population, well, they obviously wouldn't be long-timers on this earth, and they've been around since the Carboniferous time. So I've been here a long time and have had a lot of time to adapt and evolve to many different diverse ways that they can survive the winter.
Well, so let's look at some of those different ways. The first thing that popped into my mind is what's in their blood? Is there something that some kind of a glycol like you would use in your car with an antifreeze that keep them at least from freezing all the way through. And you think of the Chilean sea bass. Mm-hmm. I think there's another name for them. I can't remember what it is. But they have something in their blood that allows them to survive the really cold Arctic temperatures.
And there is
Antarctic temperatures.
Yeah, and exactly. So those insects that overwinter, say, maybe in an adult or a larval stage where they're still somewhat active. I mean, there is a decreased level of activity. There's reduced metabolism. But where they still need to support or maintain the tissues of their body, as opposed to maybe an egg or a cocoon that's in the soil that can be very inactive. But so those that overwinter in a more active state, they do exactly have glycol-like compounds. So glycerol, sorbitol, and others are in their blood. And in insects, they have what's called an open circulatory system. So rather than being in vessels like we have, moving throughout the body, it's actually in kind of an open cavity within the body, and the blood is there is some pumping organs comparable to a heart that helps keep that hemocele, the blood like material, moving the hemolymph, but it's not in vessels. And so there's an advantage to that they can get it out into the muscles, get it into the digestive tract much more easily.
So when I'm squashing a box elder bug and see what's left behind, that is just all in one, enclosed in one area, and there are little pumping vessels pushing that around inside.
Well, yes, to some extent. You do know that insects do have some segments to their body.
There's
the distinct ones are like the head and that middle region called the thorax, where the legs and wings are attached, and there's the back region called the abdomen, where the digestive system and the reproductive organs, and that's usually the squishier part of the insect. And so in that area, it is more open. There are little pumping stations, so to speak, within each segment to help keep that hemolymph, is what we call insect blood, moving, but it's not confined to vessels. And so that's why when you do squish an insect, it is so gooey so quickly, because there's just all that liquid is coming out quickly.
All right. So how do they use that as an adaptation to survive the winter? Because you'd think, okay, I mean, they're not necessarily warm-blooded.
No, they're not.
At all. So how do they... How is that more of an advantage than it would be for humans?
Okay, so they are, as you mentioned, they are cold-blooded, so they don't have as many ways to regulate their temperature as do humans, although they do use external things, like they can sun themselves on a sunny winter day. They can move to a position where they're absorbing more heat to help them. But the glycol-like substances can keep their body active enough so that they can move around. So say a Colorado potato beetle is overwintering under some old potato vines, and they're going to want to have different positions depending on what the temperatures are and what the snow level might be on the ground. And so having some activity allows them to move around. They're generally not doing much feeding at that time of year because there isn't their food source available, but they are at least, they do have some level of activity.
So what kind of energy are they using up? How do they... Their metabolism
is slowed down greatly in winter.
Quite down.
But they do have what we call fat bodies, where they'll sequester fat cells just like humans do. And they use that as energy to help provide energy over the winter. We were talking before the show that they'll often absorb energy from different places. For example, flight muscles in insects are very high energy users. And so they can, their flight muscles, if they no longer need them, because all they might do the next spring is mate with one of the opposite sex, and then the female will lay her eggs, and then they're done. I mean, their life cycle is done. So they don't need to fly anymore. So they'll reabsorb that energy from their flight muscles, put it into fat cells to help them survive the winter. A lot of times, too, insects will not overwinter in a reproductively active state, because that takes, again, a lot of energy. And so you're going to shrink down your reproductive structures so that you're not having to put a lot of energy into that over the winter.
So has science been able to find a way to take some of these adaptations and use them either against them or for other purposes. I'm thinking of
the
glycol-like substance.
Well, yeah, and hormones. And so just like humans, a lot of the development and different stages of activity of insects is driven by hormones. And so we certainly have mimicked those hormones. You're familiar with pheromones that we use for mating disruption. We can also mimic pheromones that might cause insects to become reproductively active or keep them from being reproductively active, and ways that we can cause them to be more active at a time of year when it would be disadvantageous for them to be to do so. So yes, certainly we have been exploring those kinds of ways to manage insects, reduce their populations.
Well, and it does sound like with those insects that are absorbing the energy from getting rid of those flight muscles, I mean, that correlates to humans. It's the reason why it's harder to lose fat.
Right.
Then, and it goes, if you're in a situation where you're trying to survive, your body goes after the muscle.
Exactly. Or reproductive structures or things that just take lots of energy to maintain. Yep. So that's very true.
Well, we'd like to have your questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495 or upraccess@gmail.com. Now, as far as Twitter is concerned, we're kind of waiting until we find out what the name of our program is before we come up with that. So send your questions to upraccess@gmail.com or call 1-800-826-1495. So what are some of the most interesting adaptations that you've seen? Are there any insects that we have here that you just kind of scratch your head, like, how in the heck did they do that?
How can they survive? Well, I think some of the big ones that, you know, especially you learn as a in elementary school about, you know, some of the migratory insects. So that is one way that insects escape winter in temperate climates, is they migrate away. And so monarch butterflies, we've talked about those on our show before, and what a great example they are of an insect that uses a lot of energy to get away from unfavorable conditions for the winter, but then does return to those northern climes in order to take advantage of host plants for their larvae and long summers and so forth that they can get lots of generations in.
But that's also one that I think could easily be disrupted because they tend to all go congregate in one location.
Right.
One in California, one in Mexico. I saw one monarch butterfly last year.
And that is a big concern, as you just pointed out. If these overwintering sites are disrupted, doesn't even have to be what we might think is, you know, we're not cutting the trees perhaps in those areas, but if there's a lot of urbanization, a lot of development around them, it might be enough to reduce the return of the populations to those areas. So it's not just their summer food sources. You know, we look at, well, there's still lots of milkweed around. How come we don't have monarchs? It's also their winter habitat. So migration is one of the really cool adaptations that insects have developed. But then when you think about ones that are left behind that aren't going to do that. So our good old friends, the grasshoppers, the Mormon crickets, how do they overwinter? They overwinter as eggs in the soil. And if you've ever seen a female Mormon cricket and you see that very long sword-like ovipositor on her tail end, that is so that she can get her eggs quite deep in the soil. She's trying to escape those upper layers of soil that are going to freeze hard in the winter and get it down a little lower so that her eggs will have a better chance of survival. And they're laid in a little structure. We call it an egg pod, but it's basically a gelatinous kind of that hardens material on the outside that helps protect them. And they're all clustered together, and so they gain some advantages from being in a cluster as well.
Do they have anything within the eggs that also wards off really cold temperatures?
There's not so much like glycol-like substances because they're not as metabolically active. I mean, certainly they're still alive, and there's some respiration going on there, but it's a very low level. And so, no, it's more of just the egg pod structure that provides protection, the depth in the soil that they lay the eggs, those kinds of things that help. Insects also have use a lot of wax on their cuticle, the outer surface of their body, to help keep moisture in, because loss of water is one of the big factors that insects have to deal with in terms of survival. But it can also be a factor in winter survival as well, not desiccating in the winter. And so wax is a common substance that's used to help with that too.
So when you're looking at insects that are depositing eggs in the ground, then this would be a case where if you have, I'm assuming this would be undisturbed soil,
right?
Because if you've got a garden and you're tilling and so forth, you're tilling up those eggs.
So that's why we talk about, how if you've got areas with undisturbed soil around, those are the more likely places to have grasshopper problems than if it's all tilled up, or it's planted to grass, or some other kind of vegetation.
But as we all know too well, they like to migrate. So
they will. I mean, they'll move around to find their food. But certainly, those kinds of structures. Also, when we think of some of our common pests like codling moth, the major worm in the apple and pear fruit, it actually overwinters as a larva. And you would think, well, geez, that must be a very susceptible stage to overwinter conditions. But they form a very dense cocoon with webbing. And they also, go into we call it diapause, a hibernation kind of state. So they're not active. They're not actively feeding or anything. But they'll tuck themselves first under layers of bark or other kinds of protected cracks and crevices that they can find, and then spin that tight webbing cocoon. And it really is a good, and then they can take advantage of like having glycol in their tissues as well to help them survive the winter.
What is the average life expectancy for an insect?
Oh, it varies tremendously. You can think on the very far end of the spectrum of the periodical cicadas, the 17-year cicadas. So that's obviously a very long-lived insect, but most of their life they're in the soil and not that active. And so it's only a short time that, we can see them above ground. But on the other end of the spectrum, there are, those that have just hours or a day, some of the mayflies and the very short-lived insects. So there's a big spectrum.
Generally, though, would you say that most insects live out their life in less than a year?
Oh, in general, yes.
Okay.
Especially when we think about a lot of the pest insects that we tend to focus on this show, but also even the beneficial, predators and parasitic wasps and so forth. Many of those have multiple generations in a year. So they're usually, we're talking about a month, 2 months, 3 month kind of life cycles at the longest. But we talked about the cicadas at the long end. Also, some others that are around here, some of the root feeding grubs, like the white grubs that can be pests on your lawn. The Japanese beetle was one. It has about a year life cycle, but there are some other species that can have 4 or 5 year life cycles. And so they're in the soil feeding on roots for multiple years.
So they're being protected and so forth. So looking at this open and closed circulatory system, does that have anything to do with the longevity and reproduction? Because you look at mammals, they don't usually produce a lot of offspring,
right?
But they're long-lived.
Right.
Whereas insects, they tend to produce a ton of offspring,
right,
but not very long-lived.
In general, when we look at the ecology or the typical life cycle of, say, comparing a vertebrate, a human or a large mammal to like an insect, we talk about differences in their approach to reproduction and lifespan. We talk about what we call R strategists and K strategists. And R strategists are those that will have rapid reproduction, rapid development, basically putting out a lot of offspring in a short period of time, but having a much shorter life cycle. And so insects are generally what we call R strategists. And then at the other end are the K strategists, those that are going to have much lower reproductive rates, much longer lived, longer lifespans, tend to not use up their resources as quickly. Those would be what we call K strategists. So in general, insects are more like our strategists, although there are some exceptions, as we mentioned, like the periodical cicadas.
Can you be general in saying that the larger the insect, the longer they live?
There can be some generality in that, but not completely. So there certainly are some small insects that can live for longer periods of time. There are some ants, for example, some of the social insects, where in that case, some of their strategies that they've adapted for not only surviving winter, but just for their whole livelihood is sharing of the chores, sharing of the job, so that you have different classes or different types of insects in the one colony. And some are responsible for going out and foraging. Some are responsible for taking care of the queen and her eggs and, you know, feeding the young and cleaning out the nest and so on and so forth. So there are some examples of smaller insects that have social behaviors that are going to be more long-lived.
What other research is being done on insects that science is using to take to use for humans?
Oh, wow. There's, you know, it's ongoing. Of course, you know, the most common one that we tend to think of is all the genetics work that has been done with the, what we call them, fruit flies, but they're really vinegar flies, the Drosophilids and those types. So just think of all the work that has been done on genetics that have helped lead to ability to, you know, all the great advances we've had in, you know, the human genome and understanding better the human genetics. So I'd say that's probably the most, you know, the biggest example that's out there.
And look where that's come in 15 years, because
right.
I remember when they announced they finally have mapped the genome of that vinegar, of a certain vinegar fly, and now
right.
it's grown completely from there.
So geneticists and evolutionary biologists are particularly attracted to working with insects because of that R strategy we just talked about. They're generally short-lived. You can get lots of young in a short period of time, and so it gives you lots of individuals to work on and study and get data more quickly versus working on something. I always feel sorry for those people who work on, you know, bears and elk, and they're you know, really cool animals, but when you think about trying to follow a lifespan of one, even if it's only several years, but still, it's, you know, it takes you a long time to get your data. So being an entomologist, we have the advantage of lots of data in a short time.
Well, you're listening to The Gardening Show. I almost said Access Utah. That might spill out there in the next couple weeks.
It's going to slip in, I'm sure.
Yeah, but you're listening to The Gardening Show on Utah Public Radio. If you have any questions or comments for Diane Alston, she's USU's Extension Entomologist. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us your question, upraccess@gmail.com. Well, let's go ahead and take a break in the program right now for just a little bit, and then we'll come back for the second half hour. But we're going to talk about, coming up anyway, some of the insects that we need to be watching out for, and some treatments that should be done early in the season to take care of those insects. So stay tuned.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Culinary Concepts in Cache Valley, offering catering services including international cuisine, custom menus, and handcrafted ice sculptures reaching to Bear Lake, Tremont, Preston, and Park City. Information is at culinaryconceptsonline.com.
Nearly half of preschool children in the U.S. do not go outside to play every day, and parents are less likely to take their daughters outside to play than their sons. Children's books also focus less on natural environments today than they did 50 years ago.
Did You Know That? Is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is also provided by Black Pearl Asian Bistro and Sushi in North Logan, serving traditional Chinese dishes, a taste of Thai, nigiri, sushi, and sashimi. Open 7 days a week. Information at 435-750-0888.
Welcome back to the second half of The Gardening Program here on Utah Public Radio. Again, we're inviting your phone calls, 1-800-826-1495, or your questions via email at upraccess@gmail.com. Diane Alston, USU Extension Entomologist and USU Professor, is in studio with me today. And Diane, normally you wouldn't think, okay, this time of year, what should I be concerned about? Because there's not really a whole lot that you can do. But there are some things that we should be preparing for. And so let's go ahead and start hitting those topics.
Okay. Well, as far as thinking about your garden plots outdoors that still have a foot of snow or whatever on them, the snow will be melting soon. And when you can get in there to work the soil, you don't want to work soil before it's ready because you just make big, hard clods and that's not good. But once the soil does dry out adequately that you can get in and work the soil, if you didn't do a tillage in your garden last fall, I would recommend that you do one this spring before you plant your new vegetable crops. And the reason for that is we were talking a little earlier about there are some insects that overwinter in the soil. Some of our moth pests like tomato hornworm, some of the beetle pests like flea beetles, Colorado potato beetle, squash bugs. These guys overwinter actually under debris and hidey places in the soil. And so by getting in and tilling in your garden area, what that does is can mechanically, physically damage them, but it can also just disturb the soil enough or bring them up to the surface where they're going to dry out or they're going to freeze because we're still going to have some cold temperatures for a while. And so those are kinds of activities that you can be doing as soon as you can get into work your garden.
So how do you keep insects down if you're trying to do a no-till method? I'm kind of a lazy gardener, so mm-hmm. I've got a tiller. I'm probably not going to do the no-till method, not with the size of my garden. But there are a lot out there that mm-hmm. are making that part of their organic tradition of keeping the ground as undisturbed as possible.
And there are some reasons for doing that, certainly maintaining soil, holding soil moisture, so prevent from losing as much moisture. If you planted a cover crop, say, in the fall, that's going to help keep the soil moisture in. When we do get windy days, it can, you know, keep down loss of topsoil and things like that. So there can be some advantages to that. So I'm not saying that everyone needs to till every spot, but if you have a garden area that you're planning to tilling it as soon as you can get into work, it is good because you can be reducing the insect populations ahead of planting your crops. And so the no-till approach still has some advantages to it. If you have planted a cover crop, a lot of times if you've planted, like, say, a grass over the winter, a ryegrass or something, a lot of times those are not very attractive to some of these other garden pest insects that we have. And so that can be just helpful and not allowing them to develop and reproduce on those plants.
Okay. Regarding as far as those overwintering places, that is something that could be done right now to get rid of some of, if you don't have too much snow outside,
right.
to get rid of some of those insects.
Right. Also, if you still have plant debris from last summer in your garden, so again, as soon as you can, you know, get out and walk around and pick that up and remove it, if you're putting it in a compost pile or if you're putting it in your green waste bin to take, you know, to push out to the curb, whatever you're doing, go ahead and get rid of that. Because again, those are sites where insects are overwintering. And so by removing those and disturbing them and disrupting that overwintering and early spring habitat for insects is a good way to help reduce numbers around your garden.
So where are the flea beetles overwintering? That they seem to be like the first thing that show up, and they'll just devastate any mustards that you might have.
Your radishes.
Arugula. It looks like someone took a shotgun and blew holes all through the leaves.
Exactly. So they're overwintering actually in the soil, especially where there's some debris there. That's a nice protected place for them under clods of soil. And they're some of the insects that overwinter as adults. So they're some of the ones we were talking about earlier that actually use some of these antifreeze kind of compounds in their tissues to help keep them from freezing over the winter, because they're ready to go as soon as the temperatures get warm enough and there's plant material available. They're right on it, beginning to feed and causing those holes and stunting the seedlings and actually even can cause seedling mortality as well.
In the case of the flea beetle, they can certainly hop quite a ways.
They can.
How far would you have to have a perimeter to keep the flea beetles out, or is that kind of not practical?
It's probably not really practical, but again, getting in and working your soil, if that's what you're going to do, as soon as possible. When you do plant your radishes and cabbages, and solanaceous plants are susceptible. There's different kinds of flea beetles, and they tend to, you know, there's certain different ones that attack different groups
of
plants.
So when you say solanaceous, you're talking about
tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, eggplant. My eggplant often get hit pretty hard by flea beetles. Doing good soil preparation. So then when you are ready to plant, if you can plant on a little bit of a raised bed so that you get good drainage you have nice fluffy soil that's in good condition, that will help reduce flea beetle activity. Also, maybe seeding a little bit higher rate. Basically, you're giving one to the flea beetle, you're giving one to you, kind of thing. So you're anticipating that you're going to have some loss and some damage. And so if you can seed at a little higher rate and then come back and pick out the ones that didn't do very well, and to allow the ones that are healthier to go in and fill the space.
I was going to say, although in my garden, they just love whatever I plant that's like the arugula. I had a long row. The whole thing was shredded.
Right. And it's so hard because
sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
We don't have a big enough, you know, in general, our gardens aren't large enough to be able to rotate around enough or to have that big enough buffer or perimeter. There's certainly a lot of the weeds are very good hosts for flea beetles, too. So I'm thinking of those that are in the mustard family are very attractive to some flea beetles. Also, things like lamb's quarter, the Chenopodiaceae weeds are very attractive to flea beetles. So keeping down populations of weeds can be helpful as well.
And what kind of weeds are the ones he just said?
The lamb's quarter and red root pigweed are in the
red roots all over the place.
Yeah, Chenopodiaceae, those are, there's flea beetles that really like those.
Well, we had a question from Tom in Logan. And he says he's a rookie gardener. What can he do to prevent pests before he even plants? So some of the things that we're talking about right now. Generally, though, you don't want to apply any kind of pesticide to the garden before
not ahead of time.
So there's nothing you can do to
no.
help.
So here's some kind of big picture suggestions for especially like a novice gardener that doesn't have a lot of experience. The best way to have a garden that's going to be a little more sustainable, a little more resilient, if you want to use that word, to pests. You're always going to have some insects out there that are going to, you know, feed on different plants. But if you plant a variety of things, so it's kind of like not putting all your eggs in one basket. Even if you really like broccoli or you really like arugula, yes, you definitely want to plant some of that in your garden. But if you plant a whole large area of that, you're definitely going to attract in, you know, insects that are going to like those particular plants. So plant a small row of it here, plant other things, and then maybe come back and plant another small row of it somewhere else. You can basically kind of hide plants from insects because they pick up on color, odor, in particular, cues, so chemical cues that are helping them find the plants that they like to feed on.
I was just gonna say,
can kind of hide those in your garden.
How do they know to tell everybody else? Hey, I just found a whole bunch of arugula over here. So through the pheromones?
Well, there are some examples of like bark beetles and some other insects that certainly use what we call aggregation pheromones. So they release, after they feed on a host plant, one that's good for them, it actually helps them make this chemical then they can release that calls in others to come and join them. But for the most part, most of our garden kind of insects are out there kind of doing it on their own. They're finding the plants that they like by, you know, for themselves. And it's based on odors. So what chemical odors are given off the plant, when they settle on the plant, they take a bite and say, yep, this is, you know, what I like, or this is not what I like, and they move on. So you can use camouflage, so to speak, by hiding plants, by having a lot of diversity and breaking up your planting. So instead of having all your arugula in one long row, you might have been better to have, you know, small row over here and then another part of the garden have another small row, and you might not have had as much pressure from the flea beetle.
So is that why some companion plantings can work well?
You
hear about putting marigolds in the garden.
Right.
Because they have a chemical or a smell that some insects don't like.
That's right. They can be repellent to some insects. And there's certainly some vegetable crops that are just, you know, harder to grow because there's insects that are just so attractive to them. If you are bothered by you know, worms in your cabbage or your broccoli, it's really hard to grow those cabbage family plants without having some of the caterpillar pests. But generally, they chew some holes in them. And to me, it's no big deal. You wash them off and they're, you know, very edible. But for some people, they can't handle that. And so if that's the case, well, then you probably shouldn't grow the cabbage family plants and stick to something that has less pest problems. Again, that kind of camouflage and hiding them, but also diversity and that big picture kind of look at gardening is also helpful because you can attract, having things that flower can attract in beneficial insects because a lot of the beneficial insects need a sugar source, a carbohydrate source, in addition to the protein that they're looking for or that they might be laying their eggs on for their young to feed on another insect. And so by having some flowering plants, and we've talked about this on the show, I'm not talking about the petunia. I'm talking about flowering herbs, flowering wildflowers, things that have a lot of nectar in them. And in general, the ones that humans have manipulated to have big showy flowers, they don't have the nectar because they've been selected for the big showy flowers and not for lots of good nectar. And so you want things that are flowering at different times and that are going to be attracting in the beneficial insects. And that can be very helpful to keeping down the pests in your garden.
I've noticed with a lot of the iris that I grow that the older varieties tend to attract more of the insects than some of the newer ones because of that same brain.
Interesting observation.
They've been bred for getting that color and the show to it and not so much the nectar. We have a question from someone who didn't want to go on the air. She said that she wants to know what responsibility do people have to inform their neighbors that they will be spraying. She lost a pet and was hospitalized when their neighbor sprayed. Is there a number you can call for emergency contamination?
You know, I'm not aware of that kind of a call or a place to report things. There certainly is the local health department that if you feel you have a response, either an allergic response or other kind of response to something, that you should contact and get information and help to help you deal with it. As long as a neighbor, if that's who it is spraying something that's registered, no, it's not legal use, and they're not spraying it outside of their own property, and they're doing it in a legal way, it can be very difficult to, unless you just, can convince your neighbor by talking with them and being friendly with them, not to do that, at least not on days when you're home or that kind of thing, or doing it at night when it's not going to be, people aren't out and about. But it can be, difficult to have any kind of, government or state or city kind of involvement in that. It's usually more of a personal thing, unless the individual is going off label using something that's not allowed. And then the Department of Ag, Utah Department of Ag and Food, is the agency that does regulate pesticide use, pesticide registration in the state, and they would be the ones to get involved if there was an illegal use of a product.
But where does the responsibility end? For instance, if someone is spraying and then it drifts into a neighbor's yard, well, to me it seems like the person who was spraying was being irresponsible, especially if that neighbor happens to be really sensitive, or if you're spraying to kill a particular weed, but it travels underground and starts killing the plants.
Right. And those things do happen, and they are very, they can involve litigation and they can involve, some pretty complex kinds of issues. And so they do happen. I mean, I can cite a personal example. When I lived in River Heights, the local irrigation ditch came along one side of my property, and they typically use 2,4-D herbicide in the spring to kill broadleaf weeds along the ditch. And we had some grapevines that were on actually the other side of the property, so maybe 70, 80 feet away, so not really that close, and they would get 2,4-D injury every single year.
And they're pretty susceptible
to that.
And they're
very susceptible. And, we talked to the irrigation company, the people that were, spraying the canal, and, I think it helped to talk to them. They became more aware that, what we're spraying is drifting, and it's, so they were more careful about when they would apply it, that they wouldn't apply it on any days that had any kind of a breeze or wind. you know, it didn't completely stop them from using it, but I think it cut back on how much they used, and it seemed like it did help. So that would be my best suggestion, is just to talk with whomever, you know, you feel the who's causing the problem, and see if you can't work something out. And I have heard of people being very sensitive to certain, you know, kinds of pesticides. And so maybe if your neighbor is dead set on using that, but maybe they could use it in the evening and let you know ahead of time so that you can be indoors, and then you're not out and about until the next day. And by then it's dissipated and you're not feeling any effects from it.
What kind of injury do you see from 2,4-D? I know we're kind of a little off topic here, but...
So on grapes, the leaves are just, like I said, so very sensitive, and you get this kind of strappy leaves. Instead of having the normal kind of fan-shaped leaf, it's very strappy and deformed, and it does affect their growth. They don't grow as well. They don't produce as many fruits.
Do they go yellow, or is that something else?
Usually not yellow. It's more just deformity in the leaves. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I noticed with our own canal company in Hyde Park, within a couple of years after I'd first moved in, I just happened to be watering, and I noticed the smell coming in on the water. And I'm like, okay, this is not good. And it was a demossing agent, and it killed my potatoes. And in talking with them, I've noticed that they're a little bit better about letting people know, okay, we're going to be demossing during this time period. And so you just have to kind of be watching for that.
Right. So I think for me, the best way is just open communication, you know, not doing it in a, not trying to start a fight with somebody in an accusatory manner, but just making them aware of how what they're using is affecting you or your garden, your plants in your yard. And there's many, many examples of where people have put down soil sterilant herbicides because they don't want any weeds growing in their driveway. Well, then guess what? The roots from the neighbor's tree that also were under your driveway, you know, got into there and it killed their tree. And so there, it can develop into some actual legal issues, and they aren't pleasant.
Well, and for some of us, like I have I don't have air conditioning other than the tree. I have a huge ash that's between my house and the garage. And it shades the house from 11 o'clock on.
That's your air conditioner, yep.
And if that tree were to die, we would be in a real world of hurt.
Right.
So,
I mean, again, education, people understanding how the products that they're using could potentially move off site or cause other problems is, you know, the best approach. But I realize that sometimes it takes time and communication and talking to people to make those things happen.
Well, let's talk about some specific insects, and maybe let's move indoors just a little bit. I haven't seen a lot of these lately because I'm usually pretty good with them, but mealybugs have been a problem for me in the past on my
indoor plants.
In some of my indoor plants, especially those with more strapping leaves like amaryllis.
Mm-hmm.
They love to get down inside, and they're ones that have that waxy
covering
substance
makes
that they
them a little
them.
Harder to manage. So let's just step back and mention that what are some of the most common kinds of insects that you find on indoor plants, on your house plants? So mealybugs are one of them, and they actually don't survive in our outdoor climates here in northern Utah. It's just too cold for them, but they can do very well in our indoor plants.
So also, where I haven't seen them for a while, I'm assuming I must have brought them in.
And you can get contaminated plants from the nursery or other places that you buy it at the store and it already has it on it, and you bring it home, and then you can, you know, cross-contaminate other plants. That's usually how you bring them indoors, since we don't have the environment here where they really can survive outside. But in addition to mealybugs, scale are another common, especially the soft scales can be a problem. Fungus gnats are another one that's pretty common in indoor house plants. And then spider mites, which are a relative of the insects. Those are generally the ones that we get the most questions about. And so...
And the spider mites tend to do a lot of damage.
They can. They can, feeding on the leaves, they dry the leaves out. They look kind of bronzed or silvered. So the first steps are always good plant care, just like with the outdoor plants, the same thing for the indoor plants. Make sure you have a good watering regime. So you want to water your plants typically, it depends on the environment and how dry or moist it is, but about once a week often. And then some plants vary, some need it more often. But you want to have the soil dry, not completely. You don't want it bone dry. You don't want the plant stressed, but you want the soil to dry modestly in between watering so that you don't have damp soil all the time. And the reason for that is that the damp soil can be especially problematic in increasing, like, fungus gnats in particular, because they have a larval stage that feeds on the roots and the soil, and so they thrive in moist conditions.
So the fungus gnats are the ones that you see just every time you get close to
right,
them.
Little flies. Flying around. Little tiny black flies kind of fluttering up, or you might fly by your face and I think, my plant, whatever that house plant is developing some fungus gnats. So usually how I manage it is just with the watering. I make sure that I'm getting it thoroughly dried in between, that I have good quality potting soil, and I have good drainage in my pot so that not water isn't sitting there and stagnating, because those are the kinds of conditions where you get fungus gnats. But then other kinds of tools that you can use, often just a good washdown of the plant. If it's not too large, if you're talking about a very large indoor plant, that can be difficult. But one that you can stick in your sink and just a real, and especially if you have a little, those nozzle sprayer things, and you can just wash down the plant real thoroughly every so often, can be a good way to help keep pests down. If you need something more than that, you can look at low toxicity approaches like insecticidal soaps, horticultural mineral oil. For soft scales in particular, and mealybugs, because they have that waxy coating, I like to use rubbing alcohol, and I just put it on a cotton ball or some other kind of absorbent material, and I'll just wipe down the leaves and wipe those scales right off. You have to often do these things several times, just doing it one time.
To get past generations.
Right, because you're going to still have some eggs around or some life stages that survive. You have to do them several times, so every 4 or 5 days, or maybe 2 or 3 times. And usually those kinds of techniques are good enough, unless you have a very severe infestation. And then it might require an actual, step up in terms of toxicity of insecticide. But generally, the softer approaches, the soap, the oil, the rubbing alcohol can often be enough if you're willing to put a little elbow grease, so to speak, into it.
Are there typical house plants that you would recommend avoiding because they just seem to always have insect problems?
Well,
I quit growing basil indoors because I always had whitefly issues.
Yeah, that's a good example. I know that for those that like to grow potted citrus, they tend to be big problems with scale and mealybugs in particular. So I'm sure there are. I'm not as knowledgeable about which house plants get the most pests, but certainly those that are more picky in their requirements often can be more susceptible to insects. So the ones that need to keep moister soil, certain kinds of conditions are going to be more probably susceptible to insects and mites.
I tend to like plants that you feed and water from the bottom up,
mm-hmm.
because I have a tendency to let things dry out anyway.
Right.
And so African violets, for instance, I know some people have issues with those, but I love African mm-hmm. violets, and they do so well from being watered from the bottom up, and I can't think of any insect problems that I've had with them at all.
So I think by watering from the bottom up tends to reduce the chance of having too moist of soil and having insects problems like fungus gnats. Some of the, I was trying to think of the word, I'm getting to that age where, sometimes the words don't come to my head, but not cacti per se, but what are the plants that have more
succulents?
Succulents tend to not have many insect pests, so they're a good group if you want a low care, easy care plant in your home. Succulents often do very well and don't tend to have insect problems.
Just because they have more moisture in them?
They tend to have very waxy cuticles also. Like insects use that same technique to keep their moisture in. Succulents do the same thing. And that heavier waxy cuticle generally is not as attractive for insects to feed on. And so, voila, they don't have as many bugs.
Well, that's probably why I've never seen a problem with my jade plant either.
Yep, so jade plants are a good one. Snake plants, or people call mother-in-law tongue, whatever you like to call them.
Really?
Yeah, I heard that name. Those kind that, have that harder covering on them tend to have less insect problems in general.
Well, are there any surprises that you've seen in the last year? I always ask this each year, any new insects that have invaded recently?
Well, I mean, certainly we always have some of these new invasives on our radar, and we have talked about the spotted wing Drosophila on this show before.
That's a big one. And we don't want it getting a foothold here.
We don't. And so far, I'd have to say, I mean, I never you never like to make predictions, because then if you could be proved wrong, then you'll be in your face. But so far, it really hasn't developed a foothold here. And so I think that's promising. It was first detected in Davis County, so Kaysville area, in 2010. And it's still in 2012. We did find a few, still in Davis County. It was in Layton, in a master gardener's backyard that let us put some traps up. And she had a lot of diversity of different kinds of vegetables and ornamentals with fruiting structures. And so it was good for the spotted wing Drosophila. But then orchards and other places that have had it in the past, once they, been aware of it and have been putting on some insecticides, it seems like it hasn't gained a foothold and hasn't established there. So I'm feeling pretty confident. I won't say confident. I'm feeling pretty good that spotted wing Drosophila just may not be very well adapted here, and we just might not see it really take off and become a common problem across the gardens and commercial horticulture industries. The one I am more worried about now is brown marmorated stink bug. We had a number of finds in the Salt Lake area in people's homes, so overwintering stink bugs. It's one of the negatives of them. Like the box elder bug, they congregate indoor environments for the winter. But that one has such a broad host range, basically fruits, vegetables, ornamentals, weeds, you name it. It's a very hardy insect. We have some native stink bugs here, and they tend to be little tanks, are kind of difficult to manage.
I've heard about these brown marmorated ones in places like Pennsylvania.
Right.
They're just really bad.
So numerous. And so I'm a little more concerned. That one was our first finds were in fall of 2012, so it's just appeared here in Utah. But I am concerned for that one. I think that one will likely be very well adapted here and could potentially take off and be. We do have some native stink bugs that do cause problems in our raspberries and some of our fruit crops. But this one will be even worse in that it can be very reproductively high levels, and that overwintering inside the home, the nuisance part of it. There's, if you look online, brown marmorated stink bug Google images, you'll see this picture of a couple in Pennsylvania, I believe it is, with shovels scooping them off their porch.
Oh my heavens.
So, I mean, I'm not going to say that we would be like that in a year or two, but there's the potential that they could become that numerous.
So have you seen them in other drier areas where they have adapted?
Yes, they are in parts of eastern Oregon and Washington now, and some of the Midwestern places. Maybe not so necessarily so dry, but I don't know that the dryness is going to be an impediment to them. They are native to Asia, to China, and so they occur there in some dry areas.
Do they know how those showed up? And did you say it was in Salt Lake?
Salt Lake. A couple different homes have reported finding them indoors this fall and winter. No, we did survey the people that reported the finds or that submitted the samples, whether they had brought in some, bedding plants or if they traveled recently to places that might have them. And those didn't seem to come out as possibilities. So they may just be around, and there's a few of them now, and if they continue to multiply, we'll have more in the future. So I am more concerned about that one.
Well, we'll stay on top of that one and let our audience know as that develops. Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks, Diane.
It passed so quickly.
Yeah, it does. You've been listening to The Gardening Program on Utah Public Radio. Send us your title suggestions for the program. I'm looking to name the program. Just go to upr.org and send me an email. And thanks for staying with us for this hour, and we'll be back next Thursday at 10 o'clock.
Start or expand your indoor garden and keep plants growing their best with a few simple tips. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Select indoor plants that match the growing conditions, such as light and humidity, as well as your schedule. Cacti and succulents are good choices for busy people with lots of light, while pothos and snake plants are perfect for low-light situations and people who like to provide minimal care. Water thoroughly and as needed for the plants you are growing. Most tropical plants should be watered thoroughly whenever the top few inches of the potting mix is slightly damp. Place tropical plants on a gravel tray to increase humidity, avoid root rot, and decrease your workload. Place pebbles in a saucer or other shallow container. Set the plants on top of the pebbles above any water that collects in the pebbles. As the water evaporates, it increases humidity around the plant. Group your plants together for easier maintenance and increased humidity. As one plant transpires, its neighbors will benefit from the increase in humidity. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
The Gardening Show is produced by Shalane Smith Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. The Gardening Show is a production of Utah Public Radio. You're listening to KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.